Hello and welcome to episode 112 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director here at the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 at Pearl Harbor, as well as many other postings. How are you this morning, Bill?
I'm doing well, Seth. How are you?
I'm not too bad.
You know, before we jump into today's topic, which is absolutely fascinating, I got hallelujah, people are listening to the podcast. Really happy about that. And I got, you know, somebody reached out to me via LinkedIn and said, hey, what's wrong with your voice? You don't sound like you used to when I knew you way back when. And it's not a secret, but I mean, I'll address that. Yeah, my voice is increasingly bad. Who knows how long I'll be able to continue to do this. But as some people who know me know, I was in the Pentagon on 9/11. And ever since, within a few days, I suffered from a lung infection, throat infection. And over the years, I've had increasing problems with my lungs. And I've got chronic lung disease. But it's kind of crept into my vocal cords. And so I've had vocal cord surgery to try to remove nodules. I apologize for the way my voice sounds. Yeah, believe me, it pains me more to talk than it does for folks to listen to me. But, you know, we do what we can, right? And so, you know, I appreciate folks reaching out and asking about it. And I'm being treated at the Mayo, so hopefully we'll see some improvement. But so far, it hasn't worked. But thanks for asking, folks.
You sound like a sea captain.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe I should embrace it.
That's right.
You know, the affectation or something like that.
There you go.
Well, let's move on to more important things, because today's subject is incredibly important to the conduct of the war, the Pacific War, World War II.
It most certainly is. And as our time is progressing through the calendar year of 1942 and the Pacific War, we still find ourselves stuck firmly in the summer of 1942, late June, to be clear, June 24th, to be precise. That's, of course, not when we're recording this, but this is the date we're talking about. On June 24th, 1942, is the date that an impatient and irritated, surprise here, Admiral Ernest J. King directs Admiral Chester W. Nimitz via encrypted message to prepare to, quote, capture Tulagi and adjacent positions, unquote. The following day, King presented his idea to General George Marshall and stressed the need to seize the initiative against the Japanese. The initiative that King stressed to Marshall had just been so luckily gifted to the Pacific Fleet after the victory at Midway just 17 days previous. In his conversation with Marshall, King stated that an attack in the Solomons should be executed no later than August 1st. A sparring match between the Army and the Navy ensued, with Admiral King not so tactfully stating to Marshall that he would proceed on his mission, quote, even if no support of Army forces in the Southwest Pacific is made available, unquote. Over the next several days, more sparring between MacArthur, now King, and Marshall occurred, with the text and verbiage between the threesome getting nastier seemingly by the hour. Finally, on July the 6th, 1942, the Army and Navy decided to play nice and all agreed to the design of three separate tasks. The first of such will be the topic of the following deckload. Remember what I said about a deckload in the episode about Coral Sea? Deckload of episodes of this podcast. The first task of the combined operations plan read as such. Task one, quote, the seizure of Tulagi and the Santa Cruz Islands, unquote. Plain and simple, nothing more. With those rather nondescript words, and bland words, I should add, Operation Watchtower was born. So, Bill, we've danced around the topic of Watchtower through several episodes, talking about Midway, and we even talk about it at Coral Sea because we talk about Tulagi. Watchtower is, of course, is going to become synonymous with the island of Guadalcanal. Mm-hmm. And the plan, you know, we talked about it last week when we talked about Admiral King. One of the things that I kind of poked at was, you know, something that was not his most shining moment was the rush to get this operation going.
Right.
And let's talk about that a little bit. It was a rush to move. You know, he had to move. King was impatient. He had to move. And he had to seize the initiative, which is not necessarily a wrong thing, but no. We didn't really have a whole lot of stuff to seize the initiative with, did we?
No, and really, you know, King's mind is really revealed, and the way his mind operates is revealed in the way he approaches the campaign at this point forward, because he understood the concept of centers of gravity, which was a Clausewitzian concept, and he knew that the Japanese Navy was probably their most significant center of gravity, because it enabled everything that the Japanese army was going to do. Without robust and effective control of the seas, the army was essentially going to be neutered.
Right.
And so King thought both strategically, in the way one would think in terms of chess moves. We need to move here, then we need to move here, then we need to move here. And in that regard, way more strategic than his nemesis in Australia at this point, MacArthur.
Yeah.
Because he understood the concept I will call dominoes, right? MacArthur wanted to go kind of to where the Imperial Japanese Army was without really thinking through, you know, the cascade of moves. But not only did King think in terms of these dominoes from a geographic standpoint, he also understood the importance of the time domain, the continuum, the momentum. He realized that you couldn't have a victory like Midway and then just kind of pause for 6 months, because that time would allow the Japanese to regroup and retake the initiative. We had just been handed the initiative with the unanticipated, I'll say it that way, victory at Midway. You know, of course, everybody wanted to win.
Sure.
Nobody expected to win as substantially as we did. And he realized if he didn't move quickly on something important from a strategic standpoint, we would lose that initiative and the pendulum would swing back in favor of the Japanese. So that's what was driving his August 1st timeline. And in theory, at least, the Joint Chiefs of Staff still controlled these strategic objectives. That's right. Why he needed to approach Marshall, not because he thought he needed the army to be involved, but because he wanted to kind of follow the rules and get JCS approval. But he did, as you said, Seth, say, well, look, I'm going to do this one way or another with you or without you. What he's effectively saying is, even if I don't get JCS approval, we're doing this.
So right.
That's pretty bold. And he must have known he would have Roosevelt as a Navy man. He considered himself a Navy man. Roosevelt's top cover for such a bold move. And again, he's proposing the first major amphibious operation of the war.
Right.
North Africa hadn't happened yet.
Right.
And the Army is thinking, wait a minute, a Navy and Marine Corps, you know, operation will be the first. Wait a minute, we don't want that to happen. Right. So I think there was a lot of second guessing going on. And how can we, sadly, right? How can we inter-service, internecine warfare? How can we prevent the Navy from taking the initiative with this amphibious campaign? But I think Marshall finally came to the realization that there were no other alternatives. North Africa couldn't happen without the British, right. And the British weren't ready. And is it this or nothing?
Yeah, and it you know, you mentioned the JCS, and it actually, and unless I'm wrong, and I don't think I am here, they actually never approved. It was never an approved plan. Yeah,
there was never a formal decision memorandum.
Right.
Right, exactly. You know, this, we learned so much from this.
Oh, event, for sure.
Right. The JCS process for formalizing the approval of campaign objectives evolved through the Guadalcanal campaign. We learned how to do amphibious landings. Mm-hmm. We learned so much about, you know, and this was, as it would turn out, in, at least on Guadalcanal proper, not Tulagi,
right,
almost an administrative landing, not an opposed amphibious landing. Correct. And yet, but we operated as if it was going to be opposed. We learned how to, all the shortfalls of our logistics support to amphibious landings, mm-hmm. all the shortfalls of our air support to, and close air support didn't exist really, right. Yeah. to amphibious landing. And this event, I think we both agree that this is not Midway, but Guadalcanal is the pivot in Absolutely. The Pacific War. It's the inflection point after which the tide of the war really does turn in our favor. But it's because all of these learnings, not just
yes.
the fact that we eventually prevailed over, what was it, 6 months?
Seth? 6 months, yep.
Yeah. Not the fact that we eventually prevailed, but all the things we learned how to do better during the course of prevailing.
This is the classroom. Guadalcanal, Operation Watchtower, and to be clear, Operation Watchtower encompasses the landings on Guadalcanal, the landings on Florida, Tanambogo, Tulagi, Gavutu, all that stuff, Battle of Eastern Solomons, Battle of Santa Cruz, all the naval battles, all this falls under Watchtower's mm-hmm. umbrella, if you will. Obviously, 95% of these were not planned events, but they all fall underneath this purview. And that's why I call it the classroom, because it informed, Operation Watchtower informed everything that we did from here on out. You know, from naval surface combat, nighttime combat, the use of radar, carrier warfare from here on, amphibious landings, logistics. I mean, literally everything. There was nothing.
Even submarine scouting.
Yes.
And
yes.
submarine interdiction, things Absolutely. Like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk about the Marine Corps, obviously, as we go sure. proceed. Absolutely. And just to set the stage, is important for the audience to recall that at this point in World War II, actually this point in the history of the United States military, the Marine Corps was not just subordinated to the Department of Navy, was actually subordinated to the Navy. Mm-hmm. The Commandant of the Marine Corps was a three-star. Mm-hmm. He did not sit on the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Correct.
That wouldn't change until 1945, when General Vandegrift, who we're going to talk about mm-hmm. significantly during Guadalcanal, became commandant and was given a chair on the JCS and given a fourth star. But in every way, the Marine Corps was the amphibious arm. It was the infantry arm mm-hmm. and armor and other combat arms of the Navy.
Yep.
And so in amphibious campaigns, the Navy commanded. This whole doctrine of, the admiral will command until the troops are established ashore, then then command will shift to the general ashore. None of that doctrine had been really cemented at this point in time. Right. All of that was still, we're still learning how to do all of that. And the services were not thought of as co-equals.
No.
And so,
not yet, anyway.
Oh, not yet. And so it's really important for folks to understand that, because, the natural tendency, as we talk about the many screw-ups that are going to occur throughout this campaign, and Guadalcanal is a campaign, not a battle, people will say, how did the Marine Corps let this happen? And it's going to be, they didn't get a vote. They were working for the Navy.
And that's so, right.
It's important to keep that in mind as we go forward.
It is. It is. And going forward, it's important to understand all the parts that are going into this operation. And we're going to focus right now on the build up to the initial landings on August the 7th, 1942. And I don't want to demonstrate, we want to demonstrate all the haphazard way things were done and why things turn out the way they do. Just to
Which
give you
a, why it was referred to as Operation Shoestring by
exactly,
the troops, right?
Exactly. So on July the 3rd, now keep in mind what I just said, August 7th is the initial landings. This is when the Marines hit the beaches of Tulagi and Guadalcanal, August 7th. On July the 3rd, just after Watchtower is approved, but not by the Joint Chiefs, King flies to San Francisco to meet with Admiral Nimitz. It's important to note that on July the 3rd, the name Guadalcanal was not even on the target list. Tulagi and the Santa Cruz Islands, which of course are a real place, were on the target list. Guadalcanal was not mentioned. On June 27th, so we're kind of stepping back in time, we're going to do this a little bit in this episode, to follow King's initial order to prepare and seize Tulagi, Nimitz ordered that Tulagi be captured and that, quote, the seizure of an airfield adjacent to Tulagi be captured as well. But no specified location was mentioned. Well, I mean, the only place is going to be Guadalcanal.
Yeah, it's, Tulagi was a seaplane base.
Correct.
But not so much the ground airfield that Nimitz also knew we needed from ground-based aircraft.
Exactly. On July the 5th, it is reported to Nimitz, well, actually to the Navy, that the Japanese had landed airfield construction troops and equipment on a little island called Guadalcanal. Only then was Guadalcanal added as a target for Operation Watchtower. So Operation Watchtower never was about capturing Guadalcanal, at least from the beginning. Of course, that's where all the focus goes to after this. Also, and this is important to know, that also on July the 5th, the Guadalcanal was given a code name. And this one you're going to hear a lot, called Cactus. Cactus is going to be the center point of everything that happens in the Pacific War for the next 6 months. So why did we even want to take Guadalcanal and Tulagi? Bill, we talked about this on our Coral Sea episode 107, where we say that the Japanese, as you just said, established a seaplane base at Tulagi, and that was to interdict and patrol those sea lanes in and around that area heading towards Port Moresby. Even after the defeat, the strategic defeat of the Japanese at Coral Sea, Port Moresby never really was taken off their list of objectives. They tried to do it over land through the over the Owen Stanley Mountains, which
they just changed from a sea-based attack to a land-based attack over them.
But Tulagi was still an important place. Once the Japanese established a seaplane base at Tulagi in May of 42, that base could disrupt, as I said, the sea lanes between the United States, Hawaii, Fiji, Samoa, and most importantly, Australia. The fact that any form of communication, supplier, or whatever was going to be restricted to Australia absolutely could not be tolerated by the United States. Australia was really our only main ally in the Pacific at this point. I mean, the Brits were there, obviously, as were the Dutch, but I mean, there was just the Australians are going to be the only ones that are really going to be shoulder to shoulder with us until way, way later when the British fleet comes into play later in 45. But it was feared that an establishment of a larger airfield on a neighboring island, which of course is Guadalcanal, would further inhibit shipping and sea control of those waterways to the Japanese. That was completely unacceptable to Admiral Nimitz, Admiral King. It had those lines of communication and supply between the United States, Hawaii, and Australia had to be left open. Therefore, Tulagi and of course Guadalcanal immediately became areas of prime importance. They had to be captured and they had to be controlled and held so the Japanese could not disrupt lines of communication. Yep. So the whole operation is kind of questionable from the start. You know, I mean, I understand and we understand why Guadalcanal is and Tulagi are the targets. And I say it's questionable because there's a lot of things that are thrown in here. Leaders, lack of support, too much of one thing, too little of another, that is just, you can tell this is our first time at bat, you know,
doing this. Well, King's urgency caused us not to be as prepared for the invasion as we should have been. And that would cause a myriad of problems, mostly logistic. But, you know, it would also cause us to be forced to meet, you know, meet the fleet at sea battle. Before we had fully figured out, as you said earlier, nighttime engagement tactics. Doctrine, right?
Yeah. Tactics, yeah.
And we learned very quickly that the Japanese were better at it than we were.
Big time.
You know, to the extent that they even selected sailors and for that show demonstrated better night vision to do their targeting for night campaigns and operations. The logistics from Rabaul down what was eventually called the slot,
right?
basically they were able, in fact, we jokingly referred to it as the Tokyo Express, even though it wasn't coming from Tokyo.
Right.
And our inability to interdict ships coming down the slot to the degree we needed to prevent reinforcements from taking place as we were in, you know, active combat, things like that. We suffered a great number of losses. And one of those things we're about in this podcast, we like to, you know, defeat myths to the extent we can. One of the myths that it was a very painful Marine Corps victory. And in terms of misery, the Marines suffered greatly. However, sailors suffered three times the number of fatalities than the Marines did, three or four times. And so it was a much, one could say that it was a loss, in particular in certain battles.
For the manpower, yeah.
Yeah, for the Navy, much more than it was for the Marine Corps. But the Marines suffered miserably months on Guadalcanal.
Yeah.
Until we could establish better logistic support and air support for them. We were not ready to do that
when
King ordered. But he really believed that that August timeline had to be met, again, to keep the Japanese from taking the initiative back from us.
Yes.
And he thought it would be worth the sacrifice that he must have known we would suffer. Maybe not quite as bad in ship.
I don't think to the extent, yeah.
But you know, when you talk about fatalities, any one is too many.
Sure.
But, you know, the Japanese suffered way worse than we did over the course of the campaign.
Yeah.
And so this is why it becomes an inflection point. Even though, as you say, it was questionable from the start.
Yeah.
It took months to get to the point where this would become a positive thing for us.
Absolutely. It was touch and go the whole time. And one of the reasons, at least the early part of the naval campaigns around Guadalcanal, and as you said, even though it's got the Corps involved heavily, as we'll see, it's a Navy operation. It falls under the gentleman named Admiral Robert L. Gormley. He had just recently assumed duties as COMSOPAC. So he's Commander Southwest Pacific. And as such, Watchtower falls under his purview. This is his baby.
And he was assigned to that job out of seniority, but this last assignment was not a combat related assignment. It was political, right?
Yes,
it was. He was our liaison to the Royal Navy in the United Kingdom, if memory serves.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
And
he was also buddies with Nimitz. And that's not to say that that's why he got this job, but it certainly didn't hurt. Mm. And those
and he was a vice admiral, not a four-star admiral.
He was. Right. And so to be clear, those under his command are going to be 1st Marine Division, the three carrier groups under the command of Vice Admiral Frank Jack Fletcher. I've already talked about those. So there's three individual carriers and they're under overall command of Frank Jack Fletcher.
And was Fletcher a vice admiral at Midway? I can't remember.
I don't
recall. Was he a rear admiral that had recently been promoted to vice admiral?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember. As well as the South Pacific Amphibious Forces under Rear Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner, as I had mentioned. All of these forces would be theoretically supported by land-based air under Rear Admiral McCain.
And that is John McCain, Senator, grandfather.
Correct, exactly.
Both his grandfather and his father were admirals. So his nickname was Sock McCain, as I recall.
It was Sock or Slew. I forget which one.
Slew.
Rear Admiral McCain's land-based air, he's also got, this is Gormley now, Allied Air Forces Southwest Pacific under MacArthur and General Kenny. These all are part of his web. Upon receiving the orders, and this is so vitally important to know how he reacts to this, upon receiving orders to seize, quote, Tulagi and adjacent positions, unquote, from Admiral Nimitz, Gormley immediately showed what would be his calling card, which is pessimism. Not what you want to hear from a leader. You know, you don't want to hear, oh, crap, we can't do this, from the guy in charge. You want to hear, oh, yeah, we'll get this done. You know, I mean, obviously there's more to it than that.
And you want them to believe it, by the way.
Exactly. Exactly. And Gormley immediately concluded that he and his people were nowhere near ready to tackle such an operation. And in a way, he was right. He had exactly one United States Marine on his staff, and that man had no or very, very little experience in amphibious operations. And to be clear, the Marine Corps didn't have a whole hell of a lot of experience. Yeah, they'd been training for it, but they'd yet to do it under fire, well, in this war. And another thing that is going to be a bad thing for Gormley and for everybody on Guadalcanal, frankly, and in the seas around, is that communications to and from Gormley and his staff and headquarters were hours and sometimes days late. And to me, that's absolutely inexcusable. When you are theater commander and you're the head banana, if you can't get communications in and out in a proper time, that's an issue.
Well, again, folks are going to say, how could that be possible? I've used high frequency communications before, HF, and it's largely dependent on atmospheric conditions. You know, the height of the ionosphere, for example, and it determines how the HF waves are reflected. So you could be in an HF null area, depending on the atmospheric conditions. From 1 hour to the next, things can change drastically. And he's on a ship in New Caledonia.
Correct.
And, you know, if he doesn't get the message, it's not clear. He doesn't know the message was coming in. He doesn't know to say, hey, I didn't get the message. Oftentimes they have to be, you know, relayed through, flown in or relayed through Australia, through the radio stations in Australia. And so it was horribly inefficient.
And therein lies one of the problems, though, is that Gormley never made himself and will never throughout the campaign, his entire time in that area, in this chair, never makes himself visible on the island of Guadalcanal. Mm-hmm. Not one time.
Didn't never visit a single time.
Not once.
Nimitz visited more than he did.
So did Halsey.
Within
days. And we'll get to that.
Taking command,
We're jumping ahead, but within days, you know, things start to change. But anyway, this is, again, of primary importance here. Intelligence going into this operation was virtually nil. And I mean that from the depths of my soul. I mean, there was literally hardly any information at all prior to this operation. The charts for the seas and the islands themselves were sometimes over 100 years old. And people can say, well, the islands can't change after. Yeah, dude, they do.
They actually do, yeah.
Yeah, they do.
So, by the way, Seth, that's not all that unusual. In the 1980s and 90s, I was operating in some areas of the Pacific where we were relying on soundings that were taken in the 1800s.
Oh, my God.
This is the 80s and 90s. It's better now. But, you know, before GPS, it was really hard to get to know where you were. So, yeah, this doesn't surprise me at all.
Maps of Guadalcanal were from 1910 charts. As a matter of fact, one of the maps had the island incorrectly labeled. It wasn't Guadalcanal. It was Guadalcanar on the map. So they didn't even have the damn name right. Topography was virtually
just jumping ahead for a moment too. Even when Nimitz comes into Guadalcanal to do a tour, they used a map that they had pulled out of National Geographic magazine find the island. See, as they're flying into Guadalcanal. So again,
not a way.
It's terrible.
Yes. Not a good way to start.
No.
Air power or lack thereof was a major concern, and this is going to factor in huge to the operations that are following here. Major concern before the operation even began. There were no American land bases close enough to Guadalcanal to give constant air support. The closest were Efate and Espirito Santo, and as you mentioned earlier, New Caledonia, and the mileage in there is too far to be able to constantly perform aerial support of the ground operations. Admiral McCain had a considerable amount of aircraft under his umbrella. 282 exactly was the exact number, but that number was deceiving because most of those aircraft under his command were obsolete. And even if they weren't, such as the F-4Fs, the B-17s, the P-39s, and P-400s that he had under his command, They did not, as I said, have the range to support an operation over 507, sometimes 715 miles away from the only U.S. bases in Espirito Santo and Efate, respectively, that they could do anything at all until Guadalcanal could sustain an air group or a wing or a squadron or whatever the hell could get in there by itself, which, as we're going to see, is some time. It doesn't happen immediately. And even when it does happen, it's, you know, touch and go as it goes on. So air power or air support of the operation had to come from and could only come from one location, which, of course, is the aircraft carriers. And as I mentioned, there's three. There's Saratoga, Enterprise, and Wasp. They're going to be your only air cover for the Marines as they're getting ready to land. But we'll get to that. On July 8th, Admiral Gormley flew to Melbourne, and he spoke with our old friend, General Douglas MacArthur. The problems outlined by the general and the admiral were gaining and maintaining air superiority over the islands, the beaches, and the assault ships, which, of course, was going to be tenuous and very difficult to do. In a surprising moment of truthfulness, General MacArthur admitted that his air forces probably could not interdict incoming Japanese air raids from Rabaul. And he's 100% right. They're too damn far away. They're too far away to be able to do anything at all. Did they have the numbers to do it? Yes, he did. But he could not get his air. And old Mac's defense here, there's nothing he could really do.
Yeah. Well, this is the same MacArthur who said he could take Rabaul.
Yeah, exactly.
With tens of thousands of Japanese soldiers on. But he didn't think we could take Guadalcanal with like 1,000 plus Japanese soldiers.
Right. Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Just want to make sure
he's wishy-washy on that, but he is 100% right. Is that he could not really support him.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So the protection of the islands and the beaches and the like would fall upon, as I said, Nimitz's carriers. This could and would be problematic, and that the carriers could and would be pulled out due to any threat that may arise. Therefore, leaving the transport group and the beachhead itself totally without air support. And you're going to hear this 1,000 times over the next few episodes. The basics of any amphibious operation were already less than stellar before the operation ever was launched. The U.S. would only have air cover as long as the carriers were present, and that depended on the situation, which would be very, very, very fluid. Mm-hmm. The U.S. There would be no U.S. land-based air power or air cover until a unit or units could be deployed to Guadalcanal, and who knew how long that would take.
Right.
The Allied naval force would more than likely have to fight off a Japanese counterattack, probably at night, when the Allied forces had little to no night fighting experience or training. The assault troops would have to be properly trained for not only an opposed amphibious landing — it was thought Guadalcanal would be an opposed landing — but a sustained occupation and defense with the prospect of little to no reinforcement immediately coming. I mean, this spells out disaster. Intelligence on enemy troops ashore, their number and strength, was severely lacking. It was estimated there could be anywhere upwards of 10,000 Japanese on the island, which, of course, was not the case. But I mean, again, it goes back to the intel or lack thereof. We're going into this blind. We're literally going into this with both hands tied behind our back before we ever set foot on the sands of Guadalcanal.
Right.
And this is just not how you want to start, you know.
No, it's not. And, you know, I think the biggest sin in all of this was Gormley's passive leadership. Or lack of leadership, lack of, actually, yeah, right? Yeah. Because we're going to talk about several conflicts in a moment between other subordinate leaders to Gormley, and not weighing in decisively to settle the arguments and give definitive guidance as to what the priorities ought to be was his greatest failing, and would ultimately lead to his demise. But,
absolutely.
You know, there's just so much going on here. Nimitz, through Midway, had used this concept that he referred to as the principle of calculated risk.
Right.
Where don't go into situations where you can risk taking more damage, an inappropriate amount of damage, particularly to the carriers, than, you know, you can inflict on the enemy. In this case, it's not clear to me that folks understood or realize or you know, manifested the reality that that calculated risk, you know, algorithm changes the moment you have troops ashore.
Absolutely.
Right. And the whole aspect of how you're measuring risk is, it needs to be modified. And it appeared to me, when you look at the battle in historical context, particularly as it pertains to Fletcher's, what he's going to say about how long he's willing to risk the carriers,
right,
that nobody had clarified what the priority needed to be for him.
That's abundantly clear. Yeah.
And it was no longer protection of the carriers at all costs.
No.
Right. So nobody made that clear. Right. And Fletcher didn't make Gormley didn't make that clear to him. I don't know that Nimitz even realized that these problems were developing, because I do believe Nimitz would have clarified this for him. But I think he had too much faith in his friend Gormley.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And you know, you mentioned ground troops, you mentioned, you know, Marines. We've talked about the Marine Corps really for the first time in this podcast, and certainly won't be the last. But let's talk about the people who are going to be doing this. Let's talk about the people that are going to be making this assault. The assault troops selected for this operation are going to, and this includes Tulagi and Guadalcanal, are members of what will soon become called, and are called for the intents and purposes of what we're talking about here, the 1st Marine Division, nicknamed the Old Breed. They're under the command of
Be confused with the Old Guard, which is an army.
Right. Right. So. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think you'd have a hell of a bar fight if you brought that up between two members of those units. So 1st Marine Division, 1st MARDIV for short, is under the command of a major general named Alexander Archer Vandergrift. Vandergrift is 57 years old at this time. He's been in the Marine Corps for 34 years. And he is...
Which is old for a two-star by today's standards.
Yeah.
But back then, people stayed in the Navy and Marine Corps longer, and promotions were generally limited in the interwar period. And so it is not uncommon to have somebody late in their late 50s with one or two stars, or even as a captain or a colonel.
Yeah, not at this point in the war. Later on in the war, you've got, you know, 24-year-old colonels.
Yeah.
But not now.
Right.
Not now. And you know, Vandergrift is, if the good Lord could have handpicked somebody to be the CEO of the 1st Marine Division for this specific operation, he would have chosen Archer Vandergrift. The guy is wickedly smart. I mean, he's bordering on genius. He really is, or was. God bless him. He was incredibly smart, intuitive. He could grasp a situation within seconds and figure out exactly what had to be done, who needed to do it, when, how, where, why, and with what material, which are the hallmarks of a good commanding, an excellent commanding officer.
I've always observed that the best Marine generals are incredibly smart and articulate, but they all pretend to be dumb, the simple country boys. And, you know, I don't know that Vandergrift ever pretended to be dumb like some I've seen over the decades. He was absolutely, and if you need any convincing about that, just read his speech called the Bended Knee Speech, which occurs after the war is over, when he's a commandant. And just, it will, man, this dude was smart. You're exactly right.
He was. And he was a lot like Nimitz in that he was a very good judge of character. He was a good judge. He was a good judge of people. And he had a knack for putting the right people in the right place at the right time. And I'm not talking about putting A company on the ridge over here. I'm talking about commanding officers.
Right.
And if you look at the leadership of the 1st Marine Division, and we're going to lump in the 1st Raider Battalion too, because they are working in tandem with the 1st Marine Division. If you look at the leadership of this unit, it's literally a who's who of leads the Corps, of people who lead the Corps for the rest of the war. I mean,
Chesty Puller,
Merritt Edson, Merrill Twining. I mean, people, Rupertus, Pedro de Valle. I mean, it's literally, it's a who's who
Right.
of Marine Corps commanding officers for the rest of the war. And they CGs. All cut their teeth. Yeah.
Commanding generals.
Yeah. Yeah. They all cut their teeth on Cactus here. The 1st Marine Division, let's be clear here, even though they were called the old breed, they were a brand new unit. They just recently formed. The division would be hamstrung, and this goes back to what we were saying, they'd be hamstrung by only having two of their three infantry regiments available for the initial assault. This, of course, is the 1st and the 5th Marines. The 7th Marines are on Samoa, garrisoning Samoa in the event of a possible Japanese invasion, which it was thought, and actually Samoa was on the list for the Japanese. They just obviously never got there. So the old breed is going into the fight already under strength. They're already under strength before they ever set foot on the island. On May the 1st, 5 days after the 7th Marines sailed for Samoa, the 1st Marine Division was ordered to New Zealand to prepare to be the landing force of the South Pacific Amphibious Force. This is
before the objective was defined.
Correct. Right. And this is right after they lose one of their infantry regiments. Vandergrift regiments were not ready for action. The 5th Marines had been stripped of cadre, what little there was, and experienced men during the construction of the 1st Raider Battalion. So there's a lot of Raiders that you're going to hear about and see.
They used to be 5th Marines.
Correct.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. We just reestablished Raiders 15 years ago. I think it was after 9/11 when we reestablished Raider Regiment.
Right.
But and they did pretty much the same thing as they, you know, stripped Marines out of other Marine regiments to form the Raider Regiment. But this is 5th Marines were the ones to suffer in 1942.
Yeah.
And so, Raiders.
So the Raiders are, you know, they're peak performance, but the 5th Marines are no slack against them at all. No slight, but they've been stripped of a lot of their leadership.
Yes.
1st Marines is kind of opposite in that they got the leadership out the wazoo, but they have absolutely no experience. You know, the leadership is there in the 1st Marines, but the experience level is gone. You know, really. The bright spot for the 1st Marine Division at this point is the 11th Marines. Of course, that's the artillery regiment of the division. They were highly proficient. No, they had not seen combat yet, but I mean, firing artillery. These guys were deadly accurate. They could put out volleys, you know, with incredible rapidity and accuracy. And they were equipped with some of the newest artillery, you know, we'll talk about some of the equipment that the Marines used once we get a little bit further down the line, which was of World War I vintage, but the 11th Marines were not. Like, they had the most modern artillery. They had the most modern, you know, equipment that they needed, that they absolutely had to have. And this will be vital throughout the campaign through several land battles. They really do save the infantry's bacon several times.
Their armor was pretty pathetic though, right? Their artillery is good, but their armor was antiquated, as I recall.
I don't necessarily want to say it's antiquated. It wasn't what it would be later on in the war. They went to Guadalcanal with Stuart tanks, which is a light tank, which in Europe, you know, proved to be, you know, a death useless. Box. Yeah, useless, absolutely useless. But in the Pacific, you know, we weren't shooting at Panther tanks and Mark IVs and Tigers. We're shooting at Japanese Hagos, and the 37 millimeter on the Stuart was okay. You know, it did the job, but you know. Was it what it would be later in the war? Of course not. You know,
it was used against a lot of infantry.
Yes.
It wasn't accompanied by armor. Yeah. And they were pretty effective in that capacity.
Regard. Yeah. In that regard. Yeah, absolutely. The vast majority of the Marines that were assigned to the 1st Marine Division at this time were very, very young. The average age of the division at this time is 19, despite the name, the old breed. The average age of the, you know, Johnny Come Lately United States Marine is 19 years old in the 1st Marine Division at this time. Most of these guys are post Pearl Harbor enlistees who believed in the Marine Corps' motto, first to fight. And they would certainly be that very thing, the first to fight. The division got its nickname, the old breed, from its cadre. What cadre there was, these are old school Marines. These are China Marines. These are guys from the Banana Wars fighting in Nicaragua. I mean, these are some old, salty Marines here. the, you know,
including Vandegrift, he was in the banana.
Yes. Yeah. Vandegrift, Chesty Puller, yep. You know, Chesty Puller was definitely he fit that category. He was the old breed. So the division arrives in New Zealand on June 14th, and this is just, it's like a snowball of crap that just follows after this. They arrive in New Zealand on the 14th of June. On June 26th, Vandegrift is told by Gormley that his division would assault Tulagi on Guadalcanal on August 1st.
Yeah, a little more than a month away.
Yeah, that's not a whole hell of a lot of time. And the best part about it is, due to a longshoreman strike in Wellington, the Marines themselves had to unload and what is called combat load their transports. And it took them days. And oftentimes they didn't get the transports properly loaded. And this is going to play huge come August 8th.
The importance of a combat load is you load in reverse. Right. So the first things, the thing you're going to need most, earliest, go on the ship last so that it comes off the ship first. And again, but there's a lesson here. I mean, it was New Zealand longshoremen going on strike that resulted in American deaths.
Yeah.
That can happen today. Yeah. Maybe not in New Zealand, but that very thing could happen today. And we cannot allow that to ever happen again. So,
and to my knowledge, after this occurrence, and I could be wrong here, but to my knowledge, that did not happen again for the remainder of the Pacific War. You know, when the ships left either the United States or Pearl Harbor or wherever they were staging from, they were combat loaded and they were ready to go. But that was a lesson that was learned here,
right
here. So what's the plan? What is the plan for D-Day, which is slated for August 1st for a variety of reasons? D-Day is later changed to August 7th. And what's the plan here, Bill? What are we looking at? We're looking at, you know, two infantry regiments assaulting Guadalcanal. That's going to be the 1st and the 5th Marines. Mm-hmm. And they are told that it is going to be an opposed landing, and we'll get into detail on that August 7th and the following actions in a later episode.
But we hadn't matured enough to have Higgins boats and things like that. These
not
Marines,
that you'll see, yeah.
Yeah, these Marines are landing basically having to climb over the side of the landing craft to get on the beach.
Well, and that goes back to that lack of preparedness. You know, we were landing Marines on August 7th, and there were LCVPs. There were a few, not very many, but there were a few. Mm. But we were landing them in what's called LCPLs, landing craft personnel. And you're 100% right. These are the Higgins boats, and they were made by Andrew Higgins in my hometown of the city of New Orleans, Louisiana. And they were made to run up on the beach or of, you know, of an island or river or whatever it may be. And guys are supposed to spill over the sides. It works, but is that the best way to get it done? No, but that's all we had.
Yeah.
That's all we had. And it goes back to the lack of preparation and the time in which this operation is executed. The objective for D-Day for Guadalcanal is the airfield and what would be known as Grassy Knoll. And this goes back to the lack of intel and the lack of proper maps and charts. Grassy Knoll is actually Mount Austin on the island, and Mount Austin is way the hell away from the airfield. It is not close. It is not an attainable objective on D-Day. It's just not.
But is it high ground? I mean, is it?
It is.
So it could cause the airfield to be vulnerable via artillery fire, I guess. So
and it does.
It's probably a reasonable objective.
Absolutely.
Was it, should have been like the top, within the top two objectives for this invasion? Probably not.
Not at all. For the operation, the United States Navy is going to supply two separate groups. There's a combat group and an amphib group. The combat group, as I've mentioned before, is going to be three aircraft carriers, Enterprise, Saratoga, and Wasp. This is the second Wasp. Or, I'm sorry, my fault. The first Wasp, CV-7. Yeah, so it's CV-3, CV-6, CV-7. One fast battleship. This is the first time that the fast battleships pop into the Pacific Fleet. This is USS North Carolina, BB-55. Mm-hmm. She's the first fast battle wagon that comes back into the fleet. So this is the first time that a battleship is going to be part of a combat group in the Pacific War at this point.
North Carolina, Washington eventually shows up too,
yes,
right?
Well, there's a whole slew of them that show up. But of course, yeah, Big Wash is this. She's the nautical assassin that we'll talk about come November. Later. But yeah, she definitely shows up. 9 heavy cruisers, 2 anti-aircraft light cruisers, Atlanta and Juno, both of which suffer, you know, similar fates, 31 destroyers, and 2 Royal Australian cruisers, heavy cruisers, and 1 light cruiser. That's going to be the combat group. That's a pretty substantial force of ships here. You know, this is not, you know, rowboats here. I mean, we got some serious naval power going into this.
Yep.
The amphib group's 13 cargo ships. I'm sorry, 13 transports, 6 cargo ships, 4 APDs, which are assault destroyers, if you want to call them such, and 5 oilers. So, I mean, this is a large undertaking. It's huge, frankly, at this point in the war, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the first major amphibious operation of the war, both Atlantic and Pacific.
Yeah. And I mean, to array that much power this early in the war is substantial. And it's frankly, it's a little bit, I don't like to use the word miracle too much, but this is kind of a miracle that we were able to scratch together all this juice to send to this area of the world at this time, you know, late July, early August, 1942.
Yeah. Again, we're forming this up 8 months, seven months,
yeah,
after Pearl Harbor, which is to assemble that large of a force. And of course, I'm sure there are people who are saying, why aren't all those ships facing Germany right now? What are they doing in the Pacific? Because we have a Germany first policy, right?
Right.
But again, we weren't doing anything in the Atlantic other than, you know, escorting
convoys,
transports, convoys across the Atlantic. So King was right to divert these forces to the Pacific.
And it's important to note that the USS Wasp, CV-7, came from the Atlantic.
Yeah,
she was brought because carriers were, I mean, yeah, were they needed in the Atlantic? Yeah. Were they needed more in the Pacific? Absolutely. Yeah. And King knew that. So he grabbed Wasp and through the canal she goes, and here she is. And that happened with several of the other ships that you're going to see and hear about as the events unfold over the next several months. So what are the Japanese doing? You know, we're talking a lot about the United States, but what are our friends from Japan doing?
Well, in that regard, they were doing exactly what we thought they were doing, which is building an airfield on Guadalcanal and the seaplane base in Tulagi in order to interdict, you know, shipping to our allies in the South Pacific, Australia, New Zealand. So in that regard, we had it exactly right. Mm-hmm. Now, the Japanese believed that there would be no way we'd be able to put together a ground offensive. They knew that we put together a sea-based offensive at Midway.
Right.
But they thought there was no way we could put together a ground offensive this early in the war. They didn't expect any major American offensive ground operations until 1943. Mm-hmm. And here we are in July, preparing July 42, preparing for an August invasion. So they pretty much discounted. And this explains why there was such an austere defensive force guarding the folks, most included some slaves, by the way,
right,
who were building the airfield on Guadalcanal. It was fairly, if they anticipated more appropriately our reaction to that construction of the airfield, they would have built up their forces and we would have been in big trouble.
Yeah. And I mean, that's 100% right. You know, they did not expect any kind of offensive action by us at all. And certainly not in the Solomon area. Mm. You know, they executed an operation called Operation SN, which was after Midway, was to strengthen their outer perimeter. You know, after the sinking of the 4 Japanese carriers at Midway, they realized that they had to kind of haul back a little bit and strengthen what they had. This falls into that. You know, Tulagi, they're throwing more stuff at Tulagi. This is why they're building an airfield on Guadalcanal, is to do this very thing. The focus for the Imperial Japanese Army and the Imperial Japanese Navy lay on Port Moresby and the assault over the Owen Stanley Mountains at this time. Not Guadalcanal. They did not
have, consume a lot of forces.
Absolutely. It tied down a lot of people, for a lot of Japanese, for a very long time. which helped us on the Guadalcanal side of the of the operation. Focus only shifted back to Guadalcanal just before the landings. And the only reason that it did, and by just before the landings, I mean literally a week before the landings on July 31st. And the only reason it did is because B-17s flying from MacArthur's command were dropping bombs on Guadalcanal to soften up the positions. So they're bombing the island almost daily. And it's you know, sometimes it's a flight of two, sometimes it's a flight of 12 or more. You know, it's a, it just depends on what airplanes they can get in the air at that day. Only then do the Japanese go, maybe we ought to, you know, put some effort into this airfield construction. Still never thought that we were going to land on Guadalcanal. Had no idea. They had did not believe, the Japanese as a group did not believe that Guadalcanal was any kind of a target. To your point, Bill, their defensive forces were less than meager, frankly. And this includes Tulagi, too. There were only 3,400 guys on Guadalcanal and Tulagi. So,
and that we were landing with about 10,000 Marines, as I recall.
A little bit more than that if you factor in the artillery. But still, I mean, far outnumbered. We far outnumbered the defenders. And on Guadalcanal alone, there were only 2,500, exactly 2,571 men on Guadalcanal. And some of those were Korean forced laborers. They weren't even fighting men.
Slaves,
slaves, for all intents and purposes, yes. So as far as the Imperial Japanese Army is concerned, they were not ready for anything at all in the Solomons area, well, and Guadalcanal, Tulagi. The Imperial Japanese Navy, however, was a little more prepared. They had, you know, their island base at Rabaul was, you know, a beehive of activity, and would be, you know, an anthill of activity, frankly, in the next several months. They were ready to go. You know, they had, if we were to strike in the Solomons area, they could and would send a surface force out to interdict our shipping literally within 24 hours. And that was not something that we were prepared to deal with, as our listeners will most certainly learn. The kickoff, July 26th, our fleet rendezvous off Koro and the Fiji Islands. And this is very important. That afternoon, Admiral McCain, Richmond Kelly Turner, Crutchley, and Vandergrift all met aboard USS Saratoga with Frank Jack Fletcher, conspicuously at to discuss the entire operation, the entire landing plan.
And Gormley, right? Because he's the commander. He should be there.
He should be, but he wasn't. And this is what I'm talking about. This is the whole thing here. Conspicuously absent was Gormley. He wasn't there. He sends his aide, who's a guy we'll also hear about in the future. His name just slipped my mind.
Callahan.
Dan Callahan. He sends his aide out there to represent
him. His deputy, not his aide, but
You're right. 100% right. 100% right. Sends him out there to represent his interests.
Right.
And it's not what you need to do, you know. Such is the result of this meeting that Gormley was deprived of any real operational plans of the overall operations until September, because he himself did not attend this meeting. And we already mentioned the communications.
Oh, so they moved the landing to September?
No. But that's the point.
So they went forward with the landing without any.
That's the point. That's
guidance
the point.
From the commander.
Got exactly. Yeah. So Fletcher leads the meeting. This is the same Fletcher from Coral Sea. Mm-hmm. This is the same Fletcher who from Midway. Who gets the Yorktown shot out from underneath him. Vandergrift took extensive notes in this meeting. He stated later that Fletcher seemed nervous and was also, quote, disconcertingly uninformed, unquote, about the landing plans. Fletcher stated to all in this from Vandergrift now. Fletcher stated to all his subordinates that he felt that the plan would fail, and he blamed Turner, who Fletcher said had no combat experience and as a result would hinder the operation to the extent of failure. Now, this is your overall naval boots on the ground or black shoes on the deck, however you want to frame it, commander for this assault operation, and he's basically telling, hey, you know what, guys, this is going to suck and we are going to lose before we ever start. And I'd mentioned this in Coral Sea, and we talk about it at Midway. Fletcher has his supporters. I particularly, professionally, am not one. This is not what you want a CO to do. This is not what you want a leader to do.
Yeah, and Fletcher, we said that he, you know, composed himself well during Midway,
right,
and graciously allowed Spruance to take overall command when his carrier was shot out from under him and he had to shift his flag. And that's all good, right? It was,
sure,
he kind of subordinated his ego. You know, one wonders, shouldn't he have been basking in the glory of that great Midway victory? Because history hadn't written Spruance as the author of that victory yet. It was still Fletcher's command, Midway was. And we won, right? And so for him to come into this planning session for Guadalcanal with essentially his tail between his legs, despite the major victory that he had just taken part of, if not led, is really bizarre in my view.
It is. And it's, you got to wonder if there was some sort of, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, but right, you got to wonder if there was some sort of psychological thing going on here. If he was irritated at somebody, if he felt left out of something, I don't know, but that's certainly not something that someone who, as you said, was somewhat successful, to walk in and say, guys, this is not going to work. We're going to lose. We're going to get a lot of people killed. And this just sucks.
And it's your fault, Turner, right?
Yeah.
You know, was he stung by Spruance, his subordinate, two-star subordinate at Midway, and the glory that Spruance seemed to get? I'm not going to let Turner get the same kind of glory. I'm going to put him in his place now. It's really bizarre. And I can't figure it out. And because the same claim could have been made about Spruance before Midway,
yep,
a lack of combat experience. Oh, and by the way, he's not a carrier guy and all of that. Turner was not on a carrier. He was just, he was in charge of the amphibious force that include the logistics, right? So this really should have been, in today's doctrine, the way this would work is, the carriers would support, not quite be subordinated to, but do what the amphibious forces needed them to do.
Yeah.
In this case, it was the commander of the carriers deciding for the amphibious commander, this is what I'm going to give you.
Yeah.
Forget what you need. This is what I'm going to give you.
That is 100% right. And that's 100% what happened. Because Fletcher turns around and he asks Turner, he says, how long is it going to take you to unload those transports? Turner says 5 days. Fletcher says, I'll give you two.
Which, by the way, was probably, you know, not achievable. It's taken longer than that.
Probably not.
Because of the fact that they weren't loaded properly in New Zealand.
But he says, Fletcher says, I'm going to give you two.
Right.
I'll give you air cover 2 days. What?
Yeah,
you know, he later says three. He later says, I'll give
changes
you 3 days.
It to three. But gracious.
Yeah. I mean, and I can get it to a point that Fletcher did not want to leave his carriers, you know, in a stationary location, because that's going to become torpedo bait for submarines, right? Of course it will. But to just basically walk into the initial kickoff meeting of this operation and say, you want 5 days? TS, you got two. You know what? I'll be a good guy. I'll give you three.
Yeah.
It's just not a good way to do things.
Failure to understand the objective, failure to define success.
Mm-hmm.
What does success in this battle look like? It looks like the troops having established themselves ashore and having a sustainable train of supplies that will continue to keep them operationally effective.
Yeah.
And he didn't understand that.
He didn't understand it. And frankly, he Man, we'll get to it. We'll get to it in further episodes because there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to unpack about the operation that happens in really a short amount of time, you know, from D-Day to Savo Island, the debacle at Savo Island. And that's going to be its own entire discussion. But, you know, there's a lot to unpack here and a lot of the blame to a point. You know, Fletcher was ordered to keep his carrier safe, which he did for the most part. But you gotta support those guys on the ground. And he really failed.
This is
that.
The beginning of the great mythology, I'll call it that, that has emerged around the Navy running away.
Right.
And leaving the Marines in limbo.
Right.
It's partly true. But
to an extent.
To an extent. But it starts with Fletcher.
It does. And it falls on his shoulders, at least in this beginning part of this operation. And as we'll see over the next several episodes, once we lose control of the seas that we frankly never really had, it takes a hell of a lot of blood and a hell of a lot of ships shot full of holes to gain final control over those seas with a hell of a lot of help from, you know, the airfield on Guadalcanal, which we'll get to. Regardless of the inauspicious start and the planning or lack thereof, the intel or lack thereof, the operation's underway and ain't nobody on earth going to stop this sucker. Operation Watchtower is going to happen. And it is. The fleet is at sea. The Marines are aboard the transports. The ammunition, such as it is loaded in such a way. It's happening. The fleet is on the way to the Solomons. First stop, Tulagi, right after that, Guadalcanal, on the same day. And it is what it is. At this point, it is what it is. So we're going to wrap it up. And the closing I want to read to you guys, to the listeners here. This comes from the official Marine Corps history that states regarding the beginnings of Operation Watchtower, quote, "Seldom has an operation been begun under more disadvantageous circumstances," unquote. And I cannot think of a more appropriate way to wrap that up. I don't know about you, Bill. What do you think?
Oh, I agree. Absolutely, you know, horrific things are about to happen. It's hard to believe that when you hear about all of this, that this ends up being a very costly American victory.
It does. And it from the way it starts, you never would have thought that. And the way it goes, frankly, over the next couple of months, you would never think that either. So with that, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcasts, and give us a rating and review. We would certainly appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. And also look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe to our page as well. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. We got a lot more Guadalcanal content coming your way in the next several weeks. And so once again, I'm Seth Paradin. Thank you very much for listening. Bill?
Yeah, I'm Bill Todi. And we hope to have some special guests in the rest of our Guadalcanal episodes. And so they'll be fascinating and fun. So please do tune in.
All right, guys. Thank you all very much. And we'll see you next week.